I'm Nina Pourzoukhi, and this is The World in Words. This past May, you might already know, Netflix launched the talk show Chelsea with Chelsea Handler.
I'm going to be on Netflix 3 days a week, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday.
It was a big deal because Chelsea was launched globally, meaning 3 days a week, viewers from around the globe can watch the show, and not just in English, but in 20 different languages. And to do that, Netflix had to figure out, how do you translate a talk show comedy into 20 languages in under 24 hours? How did they do this? But first, let's go back in time to figure out how we got here.
Wait a minute, I tell you, you ain't heard nothing. You want to hear Tootsie? All right, hold on.
To October 1927, when the world forever changed.
Tootsie, goodbye. Tootsie, don't cry. The little choo-choo train that takes me away from you. You don't know just how sad it makes me.
Al Jolson's voice filled movie theaters as the jazz singer, and the talkies were born.
Watch for the mail. I'll never fail. If you don't get a letter, then you know I'm in jail. Hey, hey. Don't cry, Tootsie, don't cry. Kiss me, Tootsie, goodbye.
The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence. And by PRI's The World.
Sound. In that fateful flick, when Al Jolson opened his mouth, what was lost? Directors like D.W. Griffith and Charlie Chaplin believed that cinema, that is, silent cinema, could be this shared language that would transcend all national borders, a visual Esperanto. Visual Esperanto was actually a turn of phrase that I first heard from Priya Jacquemore, a film professor at the University of Southern California. I'd called her up last year to talk about something completely different, subtitles, and she dropped this term, visual Esperanto, and it stuck in my head. So I emailed her to talk more about it.
You know, thinking about it after I got your email, I was like, where did I get that from? And it's actually a book called Babel and Babylon by Miriam Hansen. She's passed away now. She used to teach at the University of Chicago.
According to Hansen, Priya says, the idea that film could be this universal language, the visual Esperanto, bubbles up at a pretty interesting time in the United States, the time of the Nickelodeon, right around 1905 to 1910. And at this moment, America is in the midst of an immigration explosion. By the end of the first decade of the 20th century, tens of millions have arrived on America's shores. And these Nickelodeons are full of immigrants, speaking many, many languages, but watching the same short flicks.
The question is, why is it popular? Like, why are these people who do not speak English coming to these places, and why are they thronging in these Nickelodeons? And it comes about in a lot of the discourse at the time. So, you know, you see it in people talking about film as a universal language that's reaching out, and particularly sort of an American trope, it seems like, in the context of immigrants to America. So one of the critics says, you know, maybe it's the nonverbal mode of signification. So he says, quote, the imagination is appealed to directly without any circumlocution.
Images did what language could not. And this notion of film as the universal language also played into a greater discussion bubbling up at the time, according to Priya. Was this new medium merely entertainment, or was it art? The great silent film genius Charlie Chaplin, who appealed to the unwashed masses with his lovable tramp character, was also a great proponent of silent film as an elevated art form.
You see, I think art form is only really a great form by virtue of its limitations.
This is Chaplin in a 1954 interview with the BBC.
It's like paintings in two dimensions. And it's the same thing in the silent films, you see. The moment we put language to them, they heard the, and it was vocal and audible. Then we heard, we had some very bad experiences, or very dull ones at least.
Film, that is silent film, was supposed to unite our post-Babel world, to elevate us all. And then sound came in and complicated everything.
Yeah, I was just about to say the Tower of Babel had been, you know, crumbled or defeated or whatnot, that curse.
Bruce Lawton is a film historian, archivist, an all-out silent film geek. Before sound, he says, silent films were easily sent around the globe.
Once you've got the studios going, if you made some big production, you would send it to other countries by virtue of agreements that had been set up, and then all you really had to do was switch out the titles, basically the opening main titles, credits, the end title, and then any intertitles would just have to be rewritten and translated into that language, and basically that was pretty much it. For the most part, if you created a production, you could send it to other countries and not worry about the language barrier.
So it was fairly universal.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Griffith once said when the specter of sound was on the horizon, he said, why would I want to lose 95% of my audience? You know, he was also a businessman. He was concerned about the finances of it. He's like, you know, my films go all over the world.
Studios tried to figure out a way to make talkies as global as their predecessors.
One of the things that a number of the studios started to do or experimented with were they started to say, okay, here's the script. We're making, you know, this picture. And they would shoot it a number of times in different languages. Buster Keaton, who was working at MGM at that point, just at the beginning of the sound era, he made 7 sound features there. And a number of them were made in German and French and Spanish. And Keaton, whoever the lead actor or actors were, would have to recite these different languages phonetically using cue cards off camera. And then they would often cast the rest of the picture with actual actors who those languages were their native language.
That sounds and like so, laborious. Like, that sounds like it would be awful. I mean, if Keaton didn't speak, you know, Italian, that would be a terrible
picture. There's actually some surviving Laurel and Hardy early sound films where there are these alternate versions in different languages, and it's hysterical.
Sta seguro que tu mamá y tu papá se llamaban Laurel?
Seguro que sí. Por qué?
Hardy does a pretty good job, he's of at least the feeling of the different romance languages, and Stan just murders them. And I think audiences, because they're a comic duo, it was probably a plus to hear these beloved comedians that they'd gotten to know in the silent era now speaking, and their voices were very suited to them, Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy. Hearing them speaking in their own language, but you know, maybe messing it up, must have been an added bonus.
¿Dónde está?
En la Universidad de Barcelona.
Ah, vamos bien. ¿Qué es, profesor?
No, está en un frasco.
That was the first idea to how to keep those markets open.
Oh, I don't know what's funnier, their stilted delivery or their accents. So while audiences at home and abroad were accepting of this comedy duo, many actors didn't have it so easy.
Now let me hear you read your line.
And I can't stand them.
Can't.
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 I mean, the movie Singing in the Rain, of course, is a film that does it in a very comic way. All of a sudden, it's like, okay, is this particular star going to be able to continue? Do they have a voice? Do they have a voice that will carry into this new medium?
In Hollywood, many actors did not, especially many foreign actors whose accent could not transcend sound.
There were definitely performers here in the U.S. who had emigrated, and then sound comes in, and their careers are largely over. Certain performers that come to mind who were incredible in silence, Vilma Bankey, she made some pictures with Rudolph Valentino. Beautiful face, very expressive. She was from either Hungary or one of those Bloc countries and had a very heavy accent. I think another one was Camilla Horn. She was German, and so she had a very thick German accent. Now, I think Rudolph Valentino, had he lived into the sound era, he would have also had problems because he apparently had a very thick Italian accent. There was an actor, I'm trying to think of his name. I can see his face.
Carl Dane, born Rasmus Carl Thurkelsen Gottlieb. He was Danish-American.
He sadly had a very thick accent.
Yes, Mr. Jerome, I will get him right away. Calling truck 42.
What's the trouble?
I don't know. He must be dead.
Where's Steinbeck?
He's in his research room.
He had a series with another actor. They were sort of a Mutt and Jeff you know, one very short. He was very tall.
His partner, George Arthur, was British. But MGM found Arthur's accent, quote, more desirable. And slowly, MGM broke up the duo, offering Dane fewer and fewer roles.
He went from being a very well-liked performer and well-paid performer in big, prestigious MGM productions.
Making $1,500 a week in the late 1920s, not bad.
To selling, I think, hot dogs or whatever outside the studio gates.
The hot dog stand was doomed to fail, wrote his former comedy partner George Arthur. Quote, Carl opened his hot dog stand in Westwood. His own feeling of despair must have been served across the counter with the hamburgers. People could not bear to watch it, so they didn't come to buy his hamburgers.
And he eventually ended up killing himself.
He left a suicide note next to a scrapbook filled with reviews and photos from his silent film days. Of course, Dane is an extreme example of the tumult of this transition. A victim of sound, you could say. But it wasn't just Hollywood that was reeling from the transition. Again, Priya Jhakumar.
You have holdouts in a way that maybe, you know, people don't often think of. In Japan, we hear all the stuff about the unions that Benshi had, which is the people who would translate the film to the audience into Japanese. And they, you know, the Benshis had a union of their own, and they were star persona because each Benshi was kind of associated with a certain film or a certain type. And they resisted the transition to sound because it was basically making them redundant. So there's all these people who are losing their jobs thanks to the transition to sound.
The Benshis, can you explain who they were, what they did?
The Benshis are basically translators between the film screen and the audience. It was this tradition, and you sort of have that in India, but not to the extent. Japan is the example of, I think, the strongest tradition. And you would have these people who would speak to the audience, and they would know the local idioms. They would know how to do the actual work of translating it, and they would look at what was going on in the images and, you know, speak in the voices of different characters or narrate the story to the audience. So it was as much about their performance, their live performance, as about what was playing on screen. Mm-hmm. And the Benshis were extremely popular in the silent era, and they had their own union, which was one of the places, you know, there was quite a lot of resistance to the shift to sound, because after that, with sound technology coming in, they were not needed anymore.
Coming back to Charlie Chaplin, often mentioned as the great holdout, he is attributed with making the last Hollywood studio silent film almost a decade after The Jazz Singer. In 1936, Chaplin made the cleverly named Modern Times. And not only is it Chaplin's final silent film, but the swan song for his tramp character. A character that some might argue has come to symbolize cinema itself. Now, technically, Modern Times is not totally silent. It's got a synchronized soundtrack, and at the end, Chaplin sings in gibberish.
I think it actually is a really clever use of sound. It adds to the humor and the absurdity of the situation, you know, where you think that when language comes about, you're actually getting clarity, but you don't really need to know the language to understand the humor. It's just more of an affect of foreignness that he's adopting over there.
So the first time an audience hears Chaplin's voice, he's speaking nonsense, almost thumbing his nose at the new medium. Eventually, though, even Chaplin couldn't entirely buck the trend of sound. But still, even when he's speaking, he seems to be hinting at the absurdity of language. Like in his first talkie, The Great Dictator, it's made in 1940. Chaplin plays the great dictator of Tumania, Adenoin Hinkle. And he's the master of double talk.
The Wiener Schnitzel mit der Lagerbierten und der Sauerkraut. Ey, der Filuten sagt der Filetten.
Und du mir ja bist ein Ströpf in der Blitzensektor Knut. Ich bleib noch Ströpf mit der Ach.
Malone.
I love that bit. But the detail that I find most fascinating about this film is in the ghetto scenes of The Great Dictator. If you look closely at the signs on set, you'll notice something pretty interesting. Esperanto. Yeah, all the signs are written in Esperanto. And it's unknown whether or not Chaplin actually knew how to speak Esperanto. I'd wager to say that he didn't, because for all of his fluency in doublespeak and gibberish, his aptitude for real languages seemed lacking. Apparently, after living in Switzerland for decades, he failed to learn French. But what is known is that Hitler banned Esperanto. And one article that I read by the Chaplin enthusiast Phil Posner suggests that Chaplin's use of Esperanto is just that, a further dig at Hitler. And so ever since 1927, we've been trying to find a solution to this problem of sound.
So who are you guys voting for?
Undecided right now.
What do you mean undecided? You're just not following the election until what? It pops up on Snapchat?
Yeah.
I'm treating this show like the college education I forgot to get.
Salud. That's cheers in Spanish.
Thank you very much. I'm not going to lie. We like taking on big challenges. We like to figure out, can we do this?
Tracy Wright is the director of global content operations at Netflix. Her group, among many other things, figured out how to translate Chelsea 3 times a week, each time in under 24 hours.
To give you a little background on the translators, we posted a test. This was the first project in which Netflix sought to test and hire translators directly for our content. And so we tested about 5,000 translators, narrowed it down to about 2,000 who we felt like were good, and then put them through further translation testing. And our initial pool was about 200 translators who not only do they do the translation, but they also do the quality control checks.
From 5,000 to 200. Yikes. This is a grueling task. Translators have just 8 hours to turn around a translation of the 30-minute talk show. But first, before the translators even begin, a transcript is created by a 2-person team as the show is being taped. That 2-person team, well, they're called the re-speakers.
Would you like me to explain a little about what re-speaking technology is?
What is re-speaking? Yeah, exactly.
It's an emerging technology that's used similar to how you see court stenographers, but instead of it being the person typing away completely, they work with a software program that is trained to their voice. As Chelsea is speaking, the re-speaker is repeating what Chelsea is saying.
In real time, while they're watching a live show come in.
Yes. That is creating the actual English text file.
Congratulations, comma, by the way, dot, Rosé is the way, dot, I have a rap in the prompter, dot, whitest woman on the planet, comma, I think that was, dash, everybody just kind of had a furl up moment, comma, and you know what
Our first episode dot. Had Pitbull. He and Chelsea are talking about rapping, and then you have Chelsea get up and do one of her raps. That has a lot of warmth and enthusiasm and sarcasm. And then you hear the re-speaker who's being very robotic and just repeating it in this nice, even, almost staccato tone so that the software picks it up.
Sunglasses and vaccines, comma, big money and tight jeans, dot, worldwide limousines, comma, Netflix on the big screen, dash, parallel.
While the re-speakers are creating the transcript in real time, a few translators around the globe are also watching the live stream of the taping of Chelsea, and they're taking notes on things like wordplay, idioms, bad words. Translation on a tight turnaround isn't easy, but translating comedy fast? Well, that's an added challenge.
Barney Frank was on early on in the primary elections, and he made a joke of, what's the difference between a cactus and a caucus?
And the difference is that in a cactus, all the pricks are on the outside.
And so across the different translators, they really had to think about what was the humor in that joke, and then how were we going to translate that?
So have you been able to test the humor in other languages? Like, how do you know that these translators are doing well and that things are funny in Brazil, or they're hitting in Poland, or, you know, any place, Spain.
You know, that's a great question. Part of it is we don't always know. We know when we get it wrong, meaning we'll see whether it's response on social, or people can report an issue through our website if they feel like we really were off the mark on a translation.
Did you ever get it wrong? Do you have examples of like times when it's like, oops?
The only few things that we've seen pop up is more like grammar.
Who knows if comedy always translates, but what's truly universal? Nitpicky grammarians.
When you think about Netflix now as a global platform, and that we'll continue to grow subscribers outside of the United States, like meaning that English is not their first language, that content, it can't be successful if people can't connect with it, and they won't connect with it if the translation is poor.
In a funny way, Netflix is trying to recapture what was lost in the silent era, this visual Esperanto. The glaring caveat being that the content being created is very far from universal in theme and mainly produced here, but still. We're in this interesting moment in media. The internet has made communicating to one another across the globe easy, but despite all the endless chatter about the rise of global English, the Tower of Babel, it's still standing. So here's a new challenge, Netflix. You like challenges? Why don't you team up with those folks at Waverly Labs working on the real-life babelfish? You know, that creature imagined by Douglas Adams that would instantly translate any language? Well, apparently Waverly Labs is creating their own version of the babelfish. They're calling their device The Pilot, and they've raised nearly $3 million on Indiegogo to do it. It's supposed to be out this fall, or so their website says. On a side note, Patrick and I are dying to try it out and see if it works. If anyone has any in with the folks at Waverly Labs, please put in a good word. So maybe, in the future, Netflix might not need to translate anything at all. And that's all for this week. Tweet us at LingoPod. I'm at Porzuki, that's P-O-R-Z-U-C-K-I. And before I go, I'll leave you with a little Laurel and Hardy in German. It's so good.
Hör mal, diesen deine Eltern auch Laurel?
Ja, warum?
Hast du sonst noch Verwandte? Wo bist du geboren?
Ich weiß nicht.
Ach, weiß es nicht.
Ich war zu klein, das zu wissen.
Sagtest du nicht mal, du hättest einen Onkel?
Ja, gewiss.
Wo ist er?
Universität Berlin, medizinische Fakultät.
Sieh mal sie. Als Professor?
Nein.
The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence, and by PRI's The World.